The last free place in America is a parking spot.
This quote from Jessica Bruder's book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, published in 2017, frames today's episode of Lady Fiction, an episode in which we are going to the movies to discuss Chloe Zhao's 2020 film of the same name. Zhao's Nomadland won big at the 93rd Academy Awards for Best Actor and Best Director, making Chloe Zhao only the second woman after Kathryn Bigelow ever to win the Best Director Award. Due to the pandemic, the wait to see this movie was terribly long for me and for everyone I was pestering about this. And so I am super excited to be discussing it today on Lady Fiction. I would like to extend a very warm welcome to my guest today, Anna Sola.
Hi, Steffi.
Anna holds a BA in Film and American Studies from the University of East Anglia in Norwich. And she spent a year as an exchange student at Temple University in Philadelphia, where she discovered visual anthropology. Back in the UK, she earned an MA in visual anthropology from Goldsmiths College at the University of London. And after working as a freelance documentary maker and a video producer, she's now working as a podcast producer. I'm very excited to have you as a guest today, expert and connoisseurs of film. And I'm super excited that you agreed on very short notice to be my guest and discuss Nomadland with me. So welcome, Anna.
Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Me too, I can say that. So maybe we can start and go back with the opening quote, the last free place in America is a parking spot. How does the movie unfold from there? What did you think?
Well, I think it's important to mention that this is a generation of people. I think most of the people described in the movie are baby boomers, who were promised that after a successful career, they could retire and fulfill their life's wishes and, you know, have a life of leisure and be free. And now they've discovered that due to economic constraints past economic crisis in 2008, they are reduced to having small pensions. They've maybe been rendered houseless involuntarily. And they need to work out a way how to continue their lives and not starve or be in a really bad situation. And this opportunity to just sell everything, get rid of possessions, something that they were told to aspire to, you know, make money, buy stuff. So they're freeing themselves of that concept, buying a van or RV, and then hitting the road to finally partake in that liberty and pursuit of happiness that has been promised to them by, you know, all the classic American texts, including the Declaration of Independence.
The film is about a very particular group of people and a generation of people based on Bruder's book, which is a nonfiction book that portrays the nomads, modern day nomads, traveling the United States, working here and there. And we follow the protagonist, Fern, on her road there. I like that you're, on the one hand, you're saying it's an opportunity to pursue the path towards freedom and go down that mythical road of the pursuit of individual happiness through moving around. And at the same time, you stress that these are outcomes of the economic crisis, 2008 crisis. So it's a movement that it's propelled forth by economic need, while it's at the same time a question of agency that is discussed over and over again in the film. And I was very intrigued by the opening because I thought, okay, this is going to be a globalization critical film when I went to the movie. So I went in and you have a framing. Fern has to, she leaves her home because basically the town of Empire, Nevada, which was a gypsum production plant, basically the production plant closed down and the zip code is officially abolished. So there is no place anymore where she used to live before. The empire has ended. It used to be called Empire, so that's a telltale name.
Ironically.
And that's when she starts going. So I thought, okay, this is going to be a film about the big players, human capital being exploited and rolled around like tumbleweed here and there. And then I was so surprised that that's not at all the overarching narrative. It's there. You can read it in this way, but there are many instances that work differently. What did you think?
Well, I agree. It could have been. And then this beautiful thing happens. So she works at the Amazon Fulfillment Center and she meets Linda May, who is actually a real life nomad. And we'll get to that later, how these real life people were tied into the making of the movie and the book, of course. And she starts giving her advice on how to live in a van, how to survive, and invites her down to this quartzite Arizona meeting that is hosted by Bob Wells. And I had the impression that at the beginning of the film, really all options, all paths were open to Fern. And then she realizes that this might be a sensible option for her. And she, after freezing a lot while hanging out in Nevada, she then decides to follow and go to this meeting. And she's immediately greeted by these warm people. And you get the impression that this is some sort of almost a socialist gathering. You know, people take care of each other, they trade. And I thought that was another really interesting aspect. She doesn't want handouts. And I think one of the things that you wanted to discuss is the dignity of labor. We see her trying to sign on for a new job. And the officer says, well, I don't know what you'd be eligible for. And she says, well, but I like work. And she doesn't want to live off Social Security, partly because she can't, because it wouldn't be high enough, but also because she actually wants to make a living and not live off of the state. And I think that's a really important thing to many, many Americans, more so than people in other countries. So they believe in hard labor and reaping the benefits of that. And you see, even when they trade things in the movie, they do make sure that it's often not a gift, but, you know, when the guy offers her a beer, she says, well, I'll trade you for a peanut butter sandwich. Or, you know, when she gets the can opener, she says, well, I'll give you an oven mitt, which I made. So that's a really beautiful thing inside this community. They're helping each other, but they're also respecting the wish to stay self-reliant and make your own way in society as they've been taught.
Yes, it's intriguing that the gathering that we see at the opening is a Christmas gathering. So on the one hand, of course, it's an alternative community. It's also part of a utopian community. And we need to discuss this real life utopian communitarian movement of nomads traveling and this quartzite meeting. But it's a Christmas holiday. And the film features the big American holidays, if you will, where Americans return to be there with their family, and over we see different bonds, different communities forming, different kinships or maybe selected kinships forming between people who are not related, who are not part of a family, but who go and look for a different in-group and who look for resonance and recognition in different places and who find this as well. So it's a very homely opening after a very cold Nevada experience, in which she's cast out and she drives down and she's welcomed, but she's also not. So at first I thought, oh, this is a cult. She's going to be brainwashed. And then, the nomads and Bob Wells, who is a kind of a mentor or leader figure, Chloe Zhao makes him speak directly to the camera. And these are, as you said before, they're not actors. They're real nomads who tell their story and who, while telling the story, also remain remote. So they share the story, but we don't have any further insight into the hows and the wheres and the whats of how this came to be. They share what they want to share. It's not a voyeuristic, oh, look at what these people are doing, that the tone for the film sets, but it's a display of this alternative lifestyle. And this brings me right around to this super interesting concept that you pitched for this interview of visual anthropology. I am so excited to hear you talk about your reading of the film in this vein.
Okay, well, for all of those who don't know, and I'm often confronted with this when I say, well, my degree is in visual anthropology, people go, oh, that sounds interesting. What is it? Basically, it was a discipline that was born out of the necessity of anthropologists having to document their work in the field. So they would go to foreign countries and then they would write about rituals. But of course, it would be much better if they had photos or even film footage of those rituals or costumes or food or anything like that. So they became single-person directors, as we call them, so one person doing everything. And very interestingly, Chloe Zhao does the same thing. So she wrote it, she directed it, and she also edited her film. And the director of photography is her boyfriend. So, but she literally calls the shots. And we want to go back to the feminism part a bit later, but yeah, I already thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
So, but the visual anthropology then became a central part of anthropology, cultural anthropology. And one of the most prolific filmmakers, Jean Rouch, who was a Frenchman, in the 1960s decided that it was sort of time to change the process. So he would invite his subjects to take part in the filmmaking, take an active role and decide what they wanted to show. So essentially do what Chloe Zhao does now, play a fictionalized version of themselves. And then he also decided that it was time to turn away from the other, the exotic, and have an outsider's perspective, but let people in and study your own tribe, so to speak. So he made a film in 1961 called Chronique d'un été, the Chronicle of a Summer, where he studied the tribe of Parisians. Tribe, obviously, now in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And it's a really fascinating document, and it shows a lot of respect towards his subjects. And I think we find that in Chloe Zhao's work and the way that she invited everyone to collaborate in this film. And I think she's particularly interesting because she was born in China, but spent half of her life in the US. So you could argue that she's at this intersection of the traditional anthropology where you look at the other, but you could also argue that she's so much part of American society, having spent kind of 50% of her life there, that she's also part of that society now. So she's having this introspective view, a self-reflexive view on American society. And that's what I think is really interesting about this film. Because if you invite people to watch documentary films, they're often sort of hesitant and say, oh, but, you know, they're exhausting to watch. But at the same time, there's this desire to learn true stories. And you note that nowadays, a lot of fiction films start off with this note saying, based on a true story, or my favorite, inspired by a true story, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
But with this format, it almost, it takes away people's fear of having to sit through a documentary that might have, you know, blurry images, hard to hear sound, no linear narrative. So Chloe Zhao supplies us with all of that, but she keeps the truth in the story and the characters. And I think that makes it a really wonderful film and a great effort in filmmaking.
Yeah, this is so intriguing. On the one hand, of course, the anthropology is going to be the Eurocentric perspective on others. You said this so nicely, much better than I could, turning kind of the tables by somebody who spent 50% of her life or grew up in China. So it's a perspective that comes from a non-American background and then takes up a look at the tribe. And I'm very hesitant to use the word tribe here, but I want to highlight the fact that tribe in and of itself is, of course, part and parcel of an anthropological vocabulary that works on othering and exoticizing and dehumanizing or mitigating other people around the world and calling them tribes opposite, you know, whatever Europeans call themselves at any given time. So tribe is a difficult term, but it also leads us back a little bit to the logic of this community out there, because the life and how they describe themselves, it is a little bit like a tribe. And
they're a little bit like a tribe. And also, I think the word nomad obviously is traditionally used in anthropology, describing a certain type of, I think most of the time, indigenous people.
Yes, and that is also a way of othering while at the same time celebrating. So we have a double edge to that sword. When I saw Nomadland, I was thinking of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's Nomads and their mobility narratives, and that, you know, have been very, that have caught on in postmodernist theory, but they've also been criticized for exoticizing and orientalizing nomadism in a way that set themselves apart as French elitists from this movement.
So it is in a way, because if you study, for example, indigenous peoples, you will find often that they do have a cycle in the year. So they go to certain places at certain times during the year. And that's exactly what Fern does. So we are with her for a little over a year. So we see that, you know, around before Christmas time, she's an Amazon worker dealing with the Christmas rush of parcels. And then she celebrates the new year, and then she moves somewhere warmer. And so we see her repeat the same thing. And I think that's really intriguing. So it's not what many people from the outside might say. It's a, you know, chaotic, aimless life where she just sort of zigzags around the United States. But she goes to certain places and returns to them for a reason. Be it the weather or the economic prospect of being able to make a lot of money before Christmas working at a certain place and then meeting people at this meeting, for example, the Bob Wells Quartzsite meeting. And I think that's really something which many of the people in their homes don't understand, that it's not some kind of chaotic life, but it is structured a little bit like, you know, well, not like their home lives, but, you know, people are creatures of habit.
Then we have to discuss indigeneity. So if by that logic, and in your reading of visual anthropology of the film, what we see is in indigenous tribes of baby boomer Americans, mostly white, mostly of a certain age, this is what the real Americans do, then Zhao also involves that othering of the anthropological lens of the storytelling. Because the other thing that I was thinking about when you were speaking about visual anthropology is that, of course, by making people speak themselves and present a fictionalized or edited version of themselves that they want to share in a documentary, what is favorably lost is that super authoritative voiceover that we know from traditional, traditional documentaries where you see now, here you see the animals in the Sahara or in the Serengeti Desert doing this and this.
And forcing your view and forcing your interpretation. Yes. And they don't do that. And actually the cinematography doesn't do that either. Mm-hmm. So you'll note that you very often have very wide angle shots, which allows the spectator to, you know, look around the frame and pick their own focus. But then Fern comes into the image and kind of draws your gaze, obviously, to follow her. And a lot of the shots are shots, you know, following her walking to somewhere or driving to somewhere. But you still have the freedom as the audience to look at different parts of the image.
Yeah. So before we talk cinematography, which I'm really excited about, I have to make this point about indigeneity and anthropology.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yes, no, that's okay. We need to make this point because, of course, at the end of the day, even if we see this community of Quartzites, nomads, and the term nomad in and of itself is going to be a charged one in this context, it is important to note, of course, that the U.S. is a settler colony. and that the land that is being inhibited, driven through, where they park their RVs and so on and so forth, is land that did not belong to them, in the first place. So it's also open to a discussion of cultural appropriation, of nomadism, of whatever indigenous cultures and cultural practices are there. And that's a road that we can also explore and look at. And that's why I think this logic of Zhao coming from the outside, or looking at her own, at a certain tribe of Americans or a certain group of Americans in a certain context, it engages this. And I'd like to make a little caveat here and talk about her previous film, The Rider, which had a similar approach, also fiction, nonfiction approach, and was about rodeo cultures, small town rodeo cultures in the U.S., basically filmed on with a South Dakota indigenous family of rodeo riders, and evolved around a young rodeo rider who was, you know, looking for his path after being hurt. So he fell, he had a brain injury. He wasn't supposed to ride anymore, and he is faced with the decision of either going back, riding more, risking his life, or working at the department store and withering away there. And the film, The Rider, just like Nomadland, I think, does what you say. It doesn't take sides. It throws the politics and the problems into our face, asks us to think this through. Because rodeo culture in and of itself is white settlement culture. It's imbued with mobility narratives, with narrative of mastering, conquering the land, settling the land, all this absolutely abominable narrative of civilization that, you know, has resulted in real genocide and cultural genocide of the indigenous population. So she negotiates that in The Rider. And then she throws it back at us in Nomadland in so many troubling ways by using the nomad and the visual anthropology as a framework to ask Americans to look at themselves through a visual anthropology documentary and do the storytelling themselves.
And I think actually that would be a really interesting thing to learn. How do the actual indigenous people or peoples in those areas react to these, by now, I think, yes, thousands of, yes, RVs and coming into the area, staying for a long time. I mean, yes, I read that at these meetings, it started off with a couple of hundred, and to the one big meeting now, it's about 10,000 vehicles that come, and they stay for 2 weeks. And in some areas, they can stay longer. And actually, Bob Wells is campaigning for them being able to stay longer in one spot. But I think there's a law that prevents camping for more than 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
And obviously, that might be a problem, especially if there are holy sites in the area, for example. So we don't get that perspective.
Exactly. It's a perspective that's missing.
And actually also I read that in the book, unfortunately I haven't read the book, but I read about it, that there's in fact a male Muslim character that's portrayed in the nonfiction book, who, for example, makes a point of parking his van facing east towards Mecca. And I think that's a really interesting aspect that's also missing in the summary, because it is, I think, only white people we see.
There's a black woman.
There's one.
I remember
black woman.
A black woman who shares her story as well. But I was overwhelmed a bit by the whiteness of, yeah, the film. And that was one of my points of criticism. So the absence of indigenous presences, of indigenous epistemologies, and however you want to read the politics of this anthropological gaze, and then the absence of diversity. But as you said in the opening, if this is a group of white baby boomers, then this makes sense. It's also a class narrative. So I think we can gravitate a bit towards saying this is a particular group of people who have no interest and no knowledge of the indigenous spaces that they inhabit. They just go around and they pursue this American dream of mobility. They make do. They're also propelled forth by economic need. And they're shown to us in this regard. But yes, the indigenous perspective is missing. I was wondering about the trash. Where do they take the trash? Yes. That's a very practical question. We never see them throwing anything away, but I don't remember seeing any trash bags
only
either.
Only at the campgrounds, yeah. I think. Yeah. You know, she was collecting trash. And also, obviously, since they have the permanent problem of having to dispose of their own feces, mm-hmm. I think maybe they have to deal with the trash at the same time. But yeah. Obviously, yeah, if you're in the middle of nowhere, there will not be a proper place to dispose of these things.
Exactly. So,
going back to this idea of, you know, the white people invading the indigenous space, this is actually tied in the film, I felt, through the comment that is made by Fern's sister, who's likening her to the pioneers. You know, she said, your group, they're like the pioneers, you know, who left the comfort of their homes to find a better place for themselves and pushing the borders out west in the pursuit of a better life. Mm-hmm. And obviously the pioneers were white and they did invade the indigenous lands. So
yes. I mean that's the point where we can talk about the meaning of mobility in the American national narrative and in American national myths. And in American studies, this is well established that the founding, the exploration, the discovery are all mobility narratives. And these narratives are all primed on a white male Eurocentric perspective. And not only is it the pioneers, Christopher Columbus, Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon, these stories that are told over and over again, they're also re-inscribed over and over in national memory cultures, and they're celebrated. And in mobility studies, which is kind of my area of expertise right now, there's a heavy critique of that, unsurprisingly. And there's also an inquiry into why do we think mobility is positive and stasis is negative? Why are these things, and this is Tim Creswell's argument, why are these things put against each other as opposites? Why don't we conceive of culture as a mobile construct in and of itself? To do away with the national container theory is that this is the US, this is Canada, or this is North America hemispheric approach, where we say culture is a transnational concept of flows that happen between spaces, between where objects, people, and ideas travel back and forth, or they don't travel, or they are stayed. Of course, the positive troping of that nomad mobility, the nomads who just go to Arizona and hang out there because they can or because they want to, that's the opposite of that would be the unseen or stunted mobilities and motilities of people who also have a necessity to go and who also go, but who cannot because they don't have the privilege of American citizenship.
Yes, but not speaking about refugees, but talking about ordinary citizens in the United States, I think there is a higher willingness to move location, change location, move your whole family across the country for a better job. So I think it's part of the culture to uproot families in order to achieve some kind of economic gain and or even... You know, you talk about all these army brats who've attended 15 high schools during the course of their life. So I think this is something that's deeply ingrained in American culture, and it's not thought of as unusual.
So
the idea to sell up and get an RV maybe isn't so crazy in a way. And I think it's interesting, especially in, I don't have any numbers, but I know statistically French people, for example, are much more likely to die in the place that they were born in. They're not very likely to move, or maybe they go to university somewhere, work somewhere, but then they return. So this is very different, I think, from most Americans.
Yes. And still, this is American culture it's a culture. So you're talking about, movement based on job changes, education changes, that's still the narrative of the pursuit of happiness, that people pursue. So they will move for work, mm-hmm. move for education, go different places, and then move somewhere else when their work life is over and they're looking at retirement. So there's much more movement happening that's linked to social, a hope for social upward mobility.
Yeah.
That, you know, symbolic mobility.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that there's obviously a connection between, you know, like you say, social upward mobility and actual mobility.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of moving.
Yes, that's a paradigm also in mobility studies. That's why it's often linked to such a positive reading. The other thing, though, that is deeply ingrained in myths of American culture is the road trip.
Mm-hmm.
Because the nation is so big. And we are clearly taking a European perspective because we're both Europeans here. So, able to drive.
But interestingly, I mean, the West, I mean, this whole idea of, you know, the Route 66 and, you know, Easy Rider, you know, these are all the same grounds that are covered in the film. And I was really interested to see that Chloe Zhao cites Happy Together, a road movie by Wong Kar-wai, mm-hmm. Which is a Hong Kong Chinese filmmaker who made this film with Hong Kong actors in South America. They're going, you know, through Argentina to see this amazing waterfall at the end, you know, at Land's End, essentially. And I think it's really interesting that she cited that as her influence because the road trip is such an American thing.
Yes. So again, she triangulates between the Ur-American road trip and then a perspective from elsewhere. So we've talked about moving because you can or moving because you have to, and the way that the movie kind of celebrates the movement, right?
Yes. I think that the shedding of this idea that you live to work and you work to be able to consume, you know, this whole consumer culture, and that will make you happy. And obviously those people found that either they couldn't continue with it or it no longer made them happy. So when at the end of the movie, Fern returns to her storage unit to get rid of the last of her possessions, and she says, "No, I really don't need this anymore." I think then she's come full circle, you know, after 1 year of nomad life, you know, she can finally part with the last of the plates and extra clothes and lamps and what was in there and be free and self-determined and self-reliant.
Yes. So that's the thing. Is she though? I'm going to play devil's advocate here and come back to the cinematography. So you said before we have lots of long distance shots, lots of great landscape shots, car going through landscape. And then we circle back to her in extreme close-ups. We often get her face in extreme close-up, which often remains blank or contemplative. So we don't see a lot of extreme facial expressions, which is, I think she's very much earned the awards that she received, Frances McDormand, for her performance in this. So for me to read this as a freedom narrative, female self-fulfillment, road trip, yay, finally shedding all the old skin, you know, there's not so much joy. Or the moments of joy that I perceived often come spontaneously when she is surprised by sublime nature.
Yes.
When she jumps around in Badlands National Park, she tries to get lost.
She loves the redwoods, and then the I think it's Highway 1 along the California coast. You know, she goes down and down by the sea.
Yeah.
Absolutely, but that ties in with, you know, Emerson and Freneau, you know, the amazing American nature.
Yes.
That brings you closer to fulfillment. So I had this other Emerson quote written down, "Nothing can bring you peace but yourself," which is from Self-Reliance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is true in her case because she turns down all these offers. So, you know, her nice friend Dave, who invites her to stay with his family at the guest house, and it's a lovely place. And I think she likes him, but she doesn't want to be tied down, and she doesn't want to be integrated into this family, which is more than willing to have her. I mean, they're so inviting to her. Also, his daughter-in-law, and then also her sister. And time and again, you know, even when she has that nice guest room with a comfortable bed at night, then we see her crawl back into her van, and she, with a sigh and a little shiver, she goes under her covers and the duvet, and she can sleep better there. And I think that's sort of the moment when we realize that she has to move, and she can't stay there, because I think that part of her life is over. That part of her life was tied in with Bo. One thing I find a little bit hard to believe is that, you know, obviously during her sister described her as a rebel who left home as soon as she could. But then she found this domestic bliss with Bo, her husband, moving to the place where he was happy. She says that he loved Empire and he had the job that he loved there. So and she did these odd jobs like tutoring or being the cashier. But she then stayed and was happy. So I kind of found it hard to believe that she made such a crass change quickly. Mm. So I think that there's a little bit of a
in her story
disconnect in the story.
In her story, again, as she tells it, or as few people can tell it, because we don't see her with other people who've known her for a long time, and she doesn't like to talk about herself. So is it Dolly, her sister? So her sister's perspective is also one of abandonment. I think Dolly says, "You left," and then she says, "I plead guilty as charged."
Yeah, and the sister says, "Well, I would have needed you around. You know, I needed your support. I needed my sister.
Yeah,
and she was not available."
Yes, but okay. So this is the Americanist moment here. We have to go back to Emerson. And to nature and wilderness, okay?
Yes.
Because that's the logic where, on the one hand, I think the visual anthropology part is super compelling because that's a story she tells. On the other hand, it's such an American movie. It plays all the myths, the family celebrations, all the grand narratives of American culture, of whiteness, back to its viewer. So it's not an independent movie that's difficult to, it's not intellectually difficult to understand. It's not artsy fartsy, excuse my words here, but it's not complicated at all. It's really, I think it's going to speak to a broad American audience, mainstream American audience, because of the tropes and the motifs. So we have the sublime nature tropes, where she's overwhelmed by the sea, overwhelmed by the big redwood trees. And we see her rejoicing there. We see her stepping out of herself, laughing, floating in a waterfall or in a water pool, letting go, just as Emerson says. So we have the overwhelming sublime nature. I was always waiting for a beast to attack when she was out there.
Yes, in the wilderness. One of the things I was surprised about, the utter lack of crime.
Yes.
You know, no one was ever worried about being robbed or raped, mugged. Mm-hmm. And there was no, I mean, maybe a little bit in the Derek character, he looked kind of zonked out on drugs, but there was no sign of addiction anywhere.
Which makes you a little bit suspicious because it looks a little bit too nice.
I think statistically some of these people would probably be addicted to alcohol or something else. I mean we know that she likes her cigarettes, and Dave kindly, which again is rejected, you know, her manly approach, his manly approach to, as the protector, you know, "I don't want you to go to the gas station at night." That's the only hint at danger I think we get. You know, he thinks she shouldn't be going there as a woman, so he gets her the licorice. But Swanky, who's another one of the real protagonists, makes it clear, you know, and yells at her when she has a broken tire, flat tire, and she doesn't have a replacement. She says, "Well, you know, you're out there by yourself. You have to be self-reliant. You have to be able to change your own tire. You have to have replacements, and you have to know how to repair stuff." And I think that's a really useful piece of advice.
Yes.
And very true.
But there are wild beasts when she goes to the zoo. Yeah. So there are what the wild beasts, where she in one episode she goes to a kind of a zoo and she sees a crocodile where she is scared, and then and she's also scared of a python that they put around her neck. So it's the wild animals are there, only they're not in the desert, not in the places where she goes. She goes to a kept animal zoo, and we have this super weird papier-mâché dinosaur installment.
I've seen those in Utah. I've seen one of those.
So when we talk about American, let's talk landscape and space. In the Discovery narrative, the space is laid out as a virgin land. This is myth criticism, American myth criticism. It's laid out as a troped as female, ready for cultivation in any sense of the word by the white settler.
And also rendered less scary because it's described as female.
Yes, exactly. It's awaiting, it's promising. And it's a European fantasy of the better, the utopian, the no place and the better place that is then settled. And the struggle of the 19th century is then to push the space of civilization all the way to the West Coast and do away with whatever indigenous presences, epistemologies, land rights, and truths might be out there. So this rendition of nature in Chloe Zhao's Nomadland is a very traditional one. And it's also a nature that is romantically sublime. It's overwhelming. It's beautiful. It makes you, you know, lose yourself and come back to your true self. It gives you freedom. But it's not nature that needs to be preserved. It's not nature that, you know, it's there only for enjoyment. And it's not something where anybody has stewardship. So there's no eco-critical perspective there. And when we talked about the trash earlier, that's the point I wanted to make, you know?
Yeah, I think the only thing that comes up briefly is it Swanky? No, Linda May talks about this earth house that she wants to create from cans and bottles, so from recycling materials, essentially. And she wants this house there to be there for generations, and it would be self-sufficient, so run by solar energy. And I think that's not said explicitly, but I read that most of these RV dwellers do use solar energy to power their vehicles, which obviously is a sensible thing to do when you're in the desert where the sun shines down on you anyway.
But I mean, they still drive around with RVs. I mean, the driving in and of itself is exhaust fumes. It's like, it's not eco-friendly, right? So opposite this American nature, a very distinct American nature narrative, U.S. nature narrative, is the home. And when we talked about what quote to use in the opening, you proposed another quote that I found so intriguing. Can we go back to this quote? This is, I think, also the opening of a film.
This is something that Fern says, and she says, "I'm not homeless, I'm just houseless." Mm-hmm. Or did you mean the other one?
No, that's the one I meant. I saw the film in German. and the German dubbing was intriguing to me because she says, "Ich bin nicht obdachlos." So the German translation for homeless is obdachlos. And obdach is an antiquated word that we use in German only in this context, homelessness. But obdach doesn't mean home as in the home place. It means shelter. So through that logic of obdachlos, I'm shelterless, or I am not shelterless, I'm just houseless, that makes a nice trajectory for thinking about the logic of the home, because the home in the American narrative of social upward mobility is the single family home. It's the house. And she says, "I'm not houseless." And she goes,
house in the suburbs.
Exactly. And it's, of course, it's raced and classed, this concept. And the home that she says she doesn't have, or that she's looking for in the film, throughout their logics of pointing to the home that's inside, there's a tattoo that one of her coworkers has.
The Smith's quote, yes.
Yes. Can you, what's the quote again?
I'm not sure. I don't know verbatim, but it's something like, home is something that you carry inside you.
Exactly. And that echoes to Emerson again.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what. So the home place is inside you. That's what the film argues. And then in terms of cinematography, we have the other homes that are proposed to us. So She lives in a car. We see her inside her teeny tiny home in also very cringeworthy moments.
Yeah.
It's often cold. You know, it's not nice. It's not comfortable. You talked about consumer culture before. She clearly doesn't need all those comforts, but it makes you go cold when you see her freeze at night. And then the other logic is that moment where she is invited into a home for Thanksgiving. Hello, the American holiday, family holiday with all the terrace.
I have to say, as a renter, the most beautiful house imaginable. I mean, it's just like a, you know, such a freestanding house on a farm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Beautiful wooden trimmings. Beautiful family.
And the harmony inside is incredible. I mean,
yeah,
so Dave invites her.
It's not a proper Thanksgiving if no one's arguing, I can tell
you. Yeah, that's very, I mean, that was too utopian for me, but I thought that was a stylistic device of hammering home the fact with us viewers that this is the ideal American home. And we see her inside, and the cinematography when she's inside, we often get these backlit shots where the light's coming in from the outside and you only see silhouettes. And there's a key scene in the morning before she leaves this home, which could be hers, or it could be a shared home that she shares with her new family of choice, where we see her walking around the Thanksgiving table with the chairs. And she contemplates and she leaves. So this reiterates the logic of the home is inside, and the house, the thing that I own, it doesn't give you the comfort that you need.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she moves because she has to, because Empire is not a home to her anymore, but she has a house there, which is uninhabited. But the home that she seeks is also a kind of a shelter home for dealing with grief. That's the other discourse in the film with loss.
Yeah.
She, you know, lost her husband to grave sickness and she cared for him. And most of the people she meets lost someone and they all share this experience of grief and they have to make do. They are the ones that are left behind. So again, this is a concept of movement that is not chosen. It's not agency movement. It's
not chosen. And I think it's interesting, you know, they talk about the wedding band, you know, the ring that is endless, like her love for Bo. And Bob talks about how you never really say goodbye, but you will meet people down the road, whether it be, you know, the next day or the next month or years or after you die. And I think that's a really interesting motif in the film as well. You know, they are so heartfelt when they meet, but then they separate, and it's okay for them because they carry this strength and self-reliance in them.
Mm.
But at the same time, they are also kind of relying on these chance encounters where they kind of pour out their love and support for each other.
And there's a lot of circular structures if you want to take the ring as a motif starting point. So there's meetings.
Well, that's actually one of them. There's one of two artsy shots in the film where it's not in the documentary style. So you see the ring and then she takes the can opener in the next shot and she opens the can. So you have the circle.
Ah.
You know, there's a match cut with the top of the soup can. And then the other one is the shot of the beautiful turkey or chicken, and then
the
table.
It's crazy. I only saw the Campbell soup can as icon of consumer culture. It's a Campbell soup can, you know, the one that was immortalized by Andy Warhol.
Well, it's the mushroom. Vicious circle of consumerism, maybe.
Ugh. See, I didn't see it. Oh, I'm so happy I get to talk to you. Film expert person. Wow. Okay. Even more mind blowing. And that's true. That's
but you noticed
shot.
All the backlit images, which by the way are the majority of the film.
Yeah.
They are backlit with the available light.
Yeah. Natural lighting
in the desert.
Yeah.
And that's another interesting thing, because going back to her influences, so Wong Kar-wai frequently collaborated with Chris Doyle, who's Australian but thinks of himself as Chinese, and he spent most of his working days making films in China because he loved the fact that rather than building sets of things that they saw somewhere, they go there and film if they can.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this lecture on cinematography that he gave at the British Film Institute. And someone asked him, well, how did you light these amazing shots in the desert in his film Hero? Mm-hmm. And he just shrugged and he said, you can't light the desert.
No, exactly. And that makes so much. And we get these desert shots as well, which makes you as a viewer think you're there because it's natural lighting and it's authentic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so we have the circles and the logic of rituals and returns and hoping that, you know, you get to meet again. But in terms of cinematography, we also have to talk about the alternation between the landscape shots and then the workplace shots.
Yes.
Because they're so
grim.
There's so much. And that's the other artsy. I don't, it's not artsy in the sense that you use it, but that's the artistic montage where you have sublime landscape, wonderful untouched nature, individual indulging in the nature and finding herself, and then she goes to work at Amazon and she's literally swallowed
and you have
by
this
the
crass
plant.
Almost, you know, this shot which mirrors the traditional factories with people standing at these moving
assembly lines,
automated belts. With no time to stop or think, you know. And I think she comments that she's not fast enough, and then she got the wrong size sticker or something to close up the box, and it's just constant pressure. And then that horrible team leader person who says, "Give me a safety tip," you know, in the sort of you know, cheerleader language, you know. How's everyone doing today? Mm-hmm. You know, that struck me as one of the most American sequences in the film in a way.
Yeah. And that's, it belongs together. So on the one hand, you have this idealized nature. On the other hand, you have this very dreary workplace. She also works at a burger place at some point, and it's not pretty. It's not nice. She makes food for other people and it's not super great burgers. It's greasy and yucky. And it's heavy work, but she does it.
But the beach place is the worst, I think. Yeah. And I read that the author of the book, Jessica Bruder, quit. She also worked at this beach place to immerse herself in the culture. Mm-hmm. And she quit after a few days because she said it was so hard, you know, really horrible physical labor.
Yes.
And I think you see her when she shovels those beets, how heavy that work is.
Yes, that's very heavy. And it's also agricultural work. So technically that's a work of engaging with the land, but it's industrialized agriculture.
And something that's typically also associated with migrant workers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's almost where I think seeing those images, you kind of get back to John Steinbeck and the Grapes of Wrath and all these horrible conditions of the migrant workers that he described in his books. And that of course was post another American economic crisis.
And I mean, she's clearly, she doesn't complain. She wants to work, but it also, work is not so important. That's a point you made earlier. She just works a bit to get by. And because she doesn't have a home and she doesn't have a fancy car and she doesn't, you know, have any material luxuries, she can get by. And that's the dignity of labor, or maybe also of that independence that she achieves by this.
And it's a big contrast actually with what she says about Bo, who loved his job. Mm-hmm. So his job wasn't a job, it was a vocation, but hers are just ever-changing jobs, which she does because of the location and the money she gets at a given time, which will sustain her.
Yeah.
So it's more survival mode rather than doing something fulfilling.
Yeah. Yeah. Also getting by and dealing with grief and loss. The other point that I felt, though, is that there are moments. So, okay, literary studies person will pipe up whenever there's a text quoted in a film. So that is my thing. So there are also instances where we get quotes or literary quotes that she recites. And I wanted to single out one instant where she talks to this, I think it's Derek, the young guy, whom she meets twice. So again, we have a circle. First, she gives him her lighter. And then I think in the second meeting, he talks about meeting or being in love with someone. and sending letters. And but he doesn't know how to write a proper love letter. And she quotes to him Sonnet number 18 by William Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Shall I compare thee to summer's day? And it's essentially a sonnet about art that praises the beloved's beauty and says, but thy eternal summer shall not fade. So your beauty will be eternal because I write the poem, the lyrical I writes the poem that immortalizes the beloved one's beauty. So long as mouth can speak.
But also, also idolizes.
Yes.
I found.
Yes.
So his girlfriend is back home, and if he only writes to her, he can, you know, fill in the gaps, which often happens with long distance relationships. You know, you only remember the good things, and you kind of forget about all the bad things, and then you can idolize your partner. And that's what happens in Sonnet 18. Mm-hmm. And also it's a celebration of nature, because if you read it closely, actually it's much less about the person than about nature, than about the summer's day, you know, the perfect summer's day. And that's also interesting.
And the decay of nature, again, the circular structure of saying renewal, rebirth, and winter comes, death comes, and all things must fade. But the poem, the idolization will not fade because it's put into lines and words. And when I heard this, I started thinking about the logic of this artistic project, of seeing Fern as a artistic figure who goes through things and designs her life. So you said earlier, Chloe Zhao wrote, directed, produced, and edited. And she also kind of called the shots. It's a nice way to say it. Called the shots on the cinematography. So this is really an auteur cinema film that is entirely of her making. And Fern as a figure, protagonist, and experiencer of this is also independent. She turns away an option at moving in with Dave. She cuts her own path. It's easy to read her as a female version of the American Adam who goes across and explores, again, with that difference of undercutting the white male tradition of this mobility narrative and positing a middle-aged white woman who is still privileged enough to travel, but who also has to see after herself. And I was wondering if you read this as an artistic contribution in the meta level of the production and on the story level production. What do you think about this?
I do. I mean, it's a fictionalized account of real people and real facts of life. So obviously the director chose, you know, which people, which landscapes, you know, which order to show them in. You know, she obviously inserted the poetry. Why did she choose Shakespeare? Why not an American poem? And I think all these things ultimately do direct us into her message and into her viewpoint, even though she gives us certain freedoms in interpretation and where to direct our eyes. But of course, ultimately, it's a artistic product made by Chloe Zhao.
So Lady Fiction has this, I'm kind of trying to find out what is female art. Sarah, can you make a difference argument here? Or is that essentializing, saying she sees things differently, or she's a female artist different, or the gaze is different? Or, I mean, definitely Fern's gaze on the landscape is different than the normative white male gaze. That's, I think, quite obvious. Is this a feminist film?
I think it's a feminist film because the heroine is self-reliant, and when she relies on people, most of them are other females,
apart from
Bob Wells, who I would argue she relies on more for advice than Dave, for example. Mm-hmm. She keeps Dave at a distance, but she gets lots of advice from Swanky and Linda May on how to go about this life.
Yeah.
One thing that I found was not feminine was this lack of threat. I mean, I don't know how I was talking about this with someone the other day, how women often, you know, when you're on the road going somewhere, you immediately check for potential dangers. Mm-hmm. You know, can I mm-hmm. walk this way? Is it too dark? Are there suspicious people? Should I be on the well-lit side of the road? Mm-hmm. Is there something which I could use as a weapon?
Yeah.
That's something that's completely missing from this narrative. I mean, the only time she appears scared is when someone knocks on her van to tell her that she can't park there overnight.
Mm. And when she's faced with a python, she's scared by the snake.
Yeah, and the exotic animals. Yes, exactly. But those you wouldn't, which is also bizarre because I think, I mean, having been in the Arizona desert, you see so many snakes out. I mean, I'm sure that quartzite place must be ripe with snakes. Yeah.
That's interesting that you say this because I went to see the movie with my aunt, who is also a baby boomer by generation. And she said the same thing, saying she goes places and she's never afraid. I would be so afraid for, you know, somebody come to knock on my van's door or somebody, I don't know, sexual harassment or wild animals. And so I got to think that, you know, maybe it's feminist in a way that tells us women, if you're not afraid, then nothing happens, which is naive. And I would never recommend it to anyone. But it made me think, this discussion with my aunt and with other people who saw the film made me think a lot about embodiment and being a woman in the world and how the film tackles this. Because the absence of fear that she displays, that Frances McDormand performs, her self-composure also is striking.
Yeah. And when I see that, you know, that lonely, empty laundromat where she sits at night waiting for her laundry, I'm like, oh, who might come in there?
Yeah.
You know, those are the scenes where I was waiting for some obnoxious attacker to arrive. Which is sad, but
I had the same thoughts, you know. It's not like you can go any place as a woman in this world. You can't. We're kind of groomed not to go any place because we have, I'm sure most of us have experiences of odd encounters or of sexual harassment in, you know, parking garages and stuff like this. And we don't see her ever doubt herself in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
She's self-reliant in that vein and defiant also of these cultural narratives. And that's thrown back at me as a female viewer in this context, as a white, cisgendered European woman who would not maybe, I don't know, go to the laundromat at night, do puzzle and wait for the things to dry.
And I think I read about another character who's featured in the book, but not the movie. And it's said that she does have a male travel companion. I mean, they have separate vans, but they go to the same places mm-hmm. and they do things at the same time, sort of. And that sounded like a viable concept to me. Mm-hmm. Like you have someone, you know, they don't need to be your sexual partner, mm-hmm. but they can just be a companion and you have company when you need it, and you have this sense of safety, maybe strength in numbers.
Yeah. And I mean, she calls her car Vanguard.
Yeah, I thought that tied in really nicely with the pioneer concept, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, because a vanguard is someone in a military unit who goes out and stakes out the new territory.
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought that was a name well chosen.
Yes, but it also harks back to the home logic, saying this is my capsule, this is my safe place, and it's not violated. So when I'm in it, I can't be violated either, unless the car breaks down or the tire breaks. Yeah, yeah.
And I think the attachment, and again going back to the concept of home, is made clear in that scene where the van breaks down, and they suggest to her, well, you'd be better off getting a new mm-hmm. vehicle, and she says, well, this is my home, and outside of the vehicle value, I've spent so much time perfecting the inside to give me, you know, the maximum surface space and everything, storage space. And it's, and that's what makes it my home. And that cannot be replaced easily.
Yeah.
You know, that's more than $5,000.
Yeah. It's emotional value. That's not,
yeah,
not an option to give up. At the end of the day, if we ask the question, is this a feminist film? And if we kind of seem to agree that her fearlessness is a feminist inspiration, or maybe throws us back at our own fears and makes us inquire into them. We also have to talk about whiteness and privilege. So it is a class narrative, but there's an absence of diversity, racial diversity. And I'd be super curious to know, and that's a question that can't be answered here, but why are there so many people of color in that nomad community? It seems to me we didn't see any. Maybe they didn't want to go on camera. That's the gap that we don't know about. But if this is as white as it is displayed, then it also means that it's an exclusive community. It's an enclave of, it's an in-group of people that, you know, other people cannot, will not, are not asked to join. So maybe the gift giving and the sharing or the exchange trade economy is based on white privilege.
I think to a certain extent, yes. Although I think that the book suggests that there were more diverse characters. Okay. So maybe this is a choice that Chloe Zhao made, but maybe also a case of, you know, who wanted to participate and whose stories worked best. Mm-hmm. I think she talked about not wanting to politicize her film and wanting to be for it to be a sort of universal story. So obviously it's bad if universal is considered white, to be white, because then we're back in the
normalizing
where
whiteness.
We don't want to be.
Yeah.
Where we don't want to be anymore.
Yeah.
But I think one thing she said was, you know, if my parents watch this in China, it can't be such a specific problem. I want it to be about, you know, the loss of a loved one, the loss of a home, illness, something that everyone in the world can identify with. So it needed to have that universality.
Okay.
But I agree that it's actually a bad idea to make that universality a white vision. And it's especially curious coming from, we see a person of color.
Yeah. And the other thing is, of course, when we make the argument, these are all people dispersed by the 2008 crash, then those are going to be the ones who are privileged enough, who still have the van, who can still travel.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are the white middle class baby boomers who see their American dream, as you said in the opening, you know, go up in flames or go into ashes before their eyes. So it is going to be a privileged version. And it's a very distinct story that she tells of the economic crisis of 2008.
Yeah. What's also interesting is that they all appear to be single.
Yeah.
So there are no families. I mean, we see a black family in the campground celebrating their daughter's birthday, but I think they're just normal campers. They're not van dwellers. But everyone else, and whether this is a spatial constraint of the RV, Or just, you know, obviously it might be easier to live by yourself in such a small space. But I thought it's curious that they all took this decision after, you know, maybe losing their partner or whether because of death or a breakup.
So if we do hark back to the argument about visual anthropology, then it's going to be an argument about a very distinct white tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Which we started out with, which I find so intriguing, because you started talking about the baby boomers and this generation, very distinct generation of white middle-class Americans. So in this sense, this anthropological gaze shows us not what the Americans do, but what the 50-something single Americans who have come to a standstill in their life or have run into trouble in their life. What they do, they take to the road and then they meet somewhere in the desert and they go in circles and they scrape by.
And I would argue that in the mainstream view, they are the other. Because, you know, this lady who Fern runs into at the store who's with the two daughters, who's so concerned about her, and she's clearly thinking this, you know, you, I think she also invites her to live with her, you know, and she says, you know, you can't do this. This is not a life. Mm. And Fern disagrees. She says, no, I'm fine. You know, I'm doing well. Yeah. I'm doing what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's this sense of otherness imposed on her by these people whom she then has to withdraw from because it makes her feel uneasy and there's no acceptance. But in the community, there is acceptance.
And that's a logic of critical whiteness also, say, separating a group of white privileged nomads from the white mainstream home dwellers with the families. And they're all white Americans at the end of the day, who are in this imbroglio together. Good. So let's go back to the opening quote. The only free space is a parking space. What do we do with this quote?
It's the new frontier. Those of us who can't afford to fly to space, mm-hmm. like Elon Musk, mm-hmm. they have to make do with a parking spot mm-hmm. because everywhere else people tell you what to do and how to mm-hmm. live your life.
Which would be another reiteration of settler culture in the troping of freedom in this vein. I think that might be a good reading, but it also harks back to the logic of freedom in the American myth criticism or in the American myth.
Well, isn't it a little bit also like it's sort of like Walden Pond. You know, you have your free life, but then also Walden Pond is like 10 minutes from the next town. So if you want to, you can still buy your Twinkies. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I mean, ultimately, a parking spot is going to be only a parking spot destined for your car, for your tool of mobility, for your vehicle. Because if you don't have a car, you don't need a parking spot. So you have no trouble, basically. Which is why I like the quote for all its different layers. again, it's oblivious to the destruction of the living space that's been done through cars and through mobility cultures to begin with. So freedom is, again, an object of consumerism. Something that you need and that you long for, and that's ideologically marked as something that's positive, while at the same time totally oblivious to the conditions of living in America and being in America in and of itself. I think that's a great conclusion. Thank you very much, Anna. This was so intriguing. I'm really excited that you got to be here. Thank you for being a wonderful expert and a conversation inspiring partner.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And let's hope we can meet soon and go to the movies together.
Yes, that would be lovely.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I love that. Bye.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the America Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.